You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. Thank you for tuning in for this Unity Partner Program. Unity Online Radio partners with spiritual leaders from organizations whose mission and messages complement Unity's. We are pleased to bring you this program on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Thank you for joining us for the Michael Chapman Giving Show. Each week, Michael will highlight the joy of giving, as well as shed light on some of today's humanitarian heroes and donors in both the private and corporate sectors. Michael will show you why giving of yourself is truly the best gift you can receive.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Michael Chapman Giving Show. Really super excited about our guest. Gentlemen, out of originally from Michigan, now living in Indianapolis. His name is Todd DeCryder. He wrote a book called The Personal Pitfalls of Money, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Todd.
Thanks. It's glad to be here.
Well, good. You know, let's just jump right into it because there's so many things I want to ask you, because not only am I impressed with your bio and your work as someone who works as a financial advisor, but also your heart as well. Can you explain the difference of what it means to be rich versus affluent?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I think affluent, I would say, is having more than enough. And the funny thing is nobody thinks they're rich because it's having a lot of money, and nobody thinks they've got a lot of money because they know somebody who's got a little bit more. And so rich is about having stuff and being wealthy. And I would say affluent is similar to that. But the funny thing is nobody thinks they're rich at all.
Interesting. So where would most people fit? Which category?
Well, it depends. I would say more people have affluence than they think they do, because you could have affluence in regards to your influence, your time, your network, your friends. You know, you can have more than enough in those regards. And I think most people are more rich than they think they are, honestly. It's easy to know somebody who's got more than you do. But if we were just to reach out, you know, looking internationally and looking just around the world, let alone the history of the world, you know, it's pretty sure that most everybody on the phone call here is going to be in the top 1% just by having running water and plumbing and all those kind of things. So it's easy to lose perspective on what it means to be rich.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you talk about the fact that, you know, most people were not born rich. And you point out that 80% of millionaires were not born into that wealth. So how did that happen?
Well, it's an interesting thing. There's a lot of cultures have different paradigms, but shirt sleeves in three generations. Or in Italy, they say the stalls to the stars to the stalls. There's this idea that those who are rich don't really remain rich. And those that create these especially these wealth generators or high-capacity individuals, they do really great at building these empires and building these kingdoms, but don't often do the things they need to train their family on how to handle those same aspects that they're used to. And so 80% of those who are wealthy are the first generation to be so. Like a friend of mine, he started off, his dad got him a bike. He was very, very poor growing up, and the bike didn't fully work. And so what he did is he got the bike, he fixed the bike up, and he sold the bike for some money, bought another bike that didn't work, fixed it, sold it, bought it, sold it, and he went on and he bought a car. And he fixed the car, and he sold it, and he bought a business. And he fixed it, sold it, bought it, fixed it, sold it, and that's kind of how he learned to handle money. And I asked him, did you ever give your kid a broken bike? And he said, oh, no, I would never do that. But yet it was such an important part of his story. And so it's interesting to see how it affects the first generation, but also the generations who come behind.
Interesting. Very well stated. Now, so many people that I know you deal with, I most certainly have dealt with in my work in the space of philanthropy, who just say, boy, if I just had a lot of money, boy, I can solve a lot of problems.
Yep.
How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think it's actually ever an issue of the money. In my opinion, when you're sitting with a guy in a nonprofit or a gal who's trying to raise support for what they're doing, if you're implementing that vision and you're bringing about change, and you can articulate that vision, it's just getting in front of enough people to make it happen. And so I've rarely found it's an issue of the dollars. It's more of an issue of getting connected with the right people and just telling what your vision and passion is, or it's an issue of maybe implementing that vision. So if you have a vision, have a passion, you're out there making some big impact, and you're actually you've got a vision for it and you're doing it, then it comes just a matter of how do you articulate that well to potential donors so they can see what's going on. And that's the issue of the piece is knowing how to tell the story and how the passion that's there. And I found, honestly, stories do great with that. So I've got a friend of mine who runs a nonprofit specializing in helping on sex trafficking because she had experience with that. I've got another friend who runs an abortion ministry trying to help post-abortive moms because she was post-abortive. And when you hear her tell her story, you're just weeping going, wow, this is crazy. Or on another note, a gal who's a kid who started a business making hats for cancer victims, and you go, well, why did you pick that one? And she just goes, well, because my grandma had it, and her head was always cold, and she's weeping in tears, and I'm just going, I'll buy 100, you know? It's a matter of getting to that point where you can touch somebody with the vision that's been on your heart and implementing that vision and then just communicating it well.
Yeah, you know, I just really appreciate the work that you're doing, Ty. And I know that you work both with leaders in the nonprofit sector as well as those who have acquired wealth through their businesses. Answer this question, because we do get this a lot too. Many people equate money with security. So from your experience with wealth in your own life as well as a professional advisor, does this seem true? I mean, why do most people keep believing that money can provide security?
Well, we've got this idea for those that don't have money that money is going to change a whole lot of things about me. And one of those things is that we think money is going to provide security. But then just Google the term asset protection, and it's really interesting results. It's interesting to think and see all the different ways they have to go out there and protect their money. And it's weird because money does solve some problems, and it does. There's some really great things about it, so I don't want to be the only guy that's negative to it here. But it creates a whole other world of them, and one of those is that people feel like somebody's going to take advantage of them. It's kind of the cardinal sin for wealthy people. And honestly, there's actually a study done in 2007, Prince and Associates, and it looked at those between 500,000 and a million, and only about 20% feared they'd be sued unjustly. But those that have more than $20 million, 83% feared they'd be sued unjustly. And so it's interesting, the larger the assets become, the more pressure and honestly the zeros that come behind it. And so a lot of times these guys, these wealthy folks, set up their asset protection strategies to you know, keep the people, whoever they are, by the way, out. It often turns into kind of a gilded cage, and it just changes a lot of dynamics about it. But security is not one of the benefits that comes, honestly, from having wealth. And there's certain security that does. Obviously, you don't need to worry about, you know, the medical bills and that kind of thing. But there's a different level, kind of more on that psychological side, where security is kind of more fleeting for those who've been entrusted with much.
Yeah, if you're joining us now, we're having a great conversation today with financial advisor, entrepreneur, and also humanitarian Todd DeCryder, who wrote the book, The Personal Pitfalls of Money. The next question that I have for you, Todd, would be in this area, going back to this conversation about affluence, how do we stay focused? How do we get a grasp on what really matters? You refer to it in your book as the flip side of affluence. How do we get a firm grasp on what really matters?
Well, it's interesting. When we look at things that matter, a lot of times the thing that gets our attention is the next 3 to 5 days. And then we look at things kind of lifetime and legacy and an eternity, and we view those as less important. And we don't spend a lot of time with the things that aren't urgent. And I think a lot of times when we sit down, we say, all right, what would you want your legacy to be? And we spend some, maybe some soul searching and some, you know, time with a blank sheet of paper and just going, okay, what really matters to me? Like if I were to write my eulogy or I were to have my wife or my kids talk about me, what would I want them to say is true of me? And why not spend some time purposely living in light of that? Why not spend some time going, all right, these are the three things that I wish I would be known for. These are the things that I wish people would say about me at my eulogy. And start kind of on that, you know, beginning with the end in mind idea, or start on that final page and then work back in light of that. I think it's a really interesting exercise. So we can sit there and we can figure out, hey, what matters to me and what are the things that are deeply in my heart? Or maybe there's a fun exercise. Let's just imagine right now we could wave a wand and all of the people on the Forbes 400 wealthiest people in America list could be on the phone call with us. What would the things you'd want to tell them? What are kind of the talking points you would want them to know or to do? What kind of fathers would you want them to be? What kind of mothers would you want them to be? How do you think you'd want them to use their money? And that, I think, is a revealing exercise to go, okay, these are the things that are passionate to you. And then the challenging question is what of those talking points that you would give to those wealthy folks, what of those are you taking action on? And I think that's a really challenging exercise.
I like that. That's a great exercise and something that needs to be tried by all of us that are listening. You talk about in your book also this term called seaworthy legacy throughout your book. And what does that mean and why is that so important to you?
Well, it's going to the long-term perspective again. And the attitude, let's just picture a second. We're going from a long journey. I don't know if it's Paris to New York or something like this. And if we start that journey in a ship and we don't really have a clue where we're going, and just we could be off by a fraction of a degree and we get to Miami instead of New York, it changes the perspective on it. It's the idea of making sure the ladder's leaning against the right wall instead of just worrying about the tactics of getting life done. It's stepping back and saying, all right, in light of my legacy, in light of the things that I'd want to become, how do I do that in such a way ahead of time and purposely kind of thinking through that idea and deciding where would I want to go? What's the kind of person I would be? And then kind of putting some things in light of that. So it's looking at a legacy in a way that would matter with the storms of life, if you want to kind of go a little bit cheesy with it. When it comes in the way, what are the things that can pull you off of that? And how do we make sure the legacy and the things we're doing and the lessons we're teaching our kids are the ones we'd want there, and to put them there kind of by purpose instead of by default?
So what is the scariest or most difficult thing about affluence for you personally?
So from my standpoint, when I look at it, I want to matter at the things that truly matter. So I don't want to get to the end of my life and just go, hey, I made some money, you know, I did some impact, I did whatever. The thing that I think scares me is just mattering at things that don't have any significance. And so getting to the end of the life and going, yeah, I you know, I built a business or two and I spent a lot of time doing things that were not bad. But just they weren't the things that really mattered. And I don't want to get to the end of my life and think, great, I built this empire, I did all these great things, but my wife doesn't really want to hang out with me anymore now that my kids have left the house and my kids never call. I want to matter at the things that really matter in life and be significant. Because honestly, whatever the cause is, whatever the industry is, whatever the widget we're making, somebody else could come along and do those things. Those are not unique to me. I don't want to trade the things that are unique, like my title of husband and father and brother and son. I don't want to trade those titles for the things that are unique and common. And so I don't want to get to the end of my life and go, great, I did well with things that really don't matter as much.
That's very powerful, and you're right. And it just there's so many people that are on that road, and how do we get off? I mean, that's not one of the prepared list of questions that I have for you, but since you brought it up, Todd, I see so many people on that path, majoring in things that really don't matter. How do we get them off of that?
So I think a lot of us treat success like a dog chasing a car. We don't really think about what would happen if we get it, you know? And so a lot of us need to maybe just take a second and go, okay, wait. So I'm climbing this ladder, I'm treadmill, whatever illustration you want to use. I'm doing the tactics, and the strategy things. Let me step back and look at vision a second. Do I need to look at, honestly, without any self-deception, what are the things that are doing? How am I really doing with my family? How am I doing with my kids? Can I name, you know, if you've got more than one kid, Can you name four or five unique things about each kid? Well, if not, you probably need to spend more time loving on your kiddos. If your wife and you, or your husband and you, haven't connected on some deep levels in a while, what can we do? You know, because it's easy to fall in love, man, but staying in love and wooing your spouse is hard on a regular basis. That's different. And so maybe it's asking some of these deeper questions that you haven't really looked at in a while. You know, what would the 10-year-old version of yourself say to you right now of wow, you succeeded, you've done all those things, obviously you would have by this time, and asking some deeper questions about, you know, why are you as affluent as you are? Why do you have as much influence as you do? What's the purpose? And why are you doing the things you're doing? And so those tough questions, and sitting down and just giving yourself some space to ask it, because life gets busy. You know, we get in light of just taking the kids, whatever your season of life is. For me, my oldest is in sixth grade, and it's amazing how many things that we have on a regular basis of just, I feel like I'm constantly chauffeuring my kids to the next thing. And man, we slam some food down, we toss fast food back, or a, you know, Nutri-Grain bar on the way to the next deal, and we just kind of chug on with the things that we're doing. And man, the days are long, but the years are quick. And we turn around and we're going, wow, my kid's how old? And oh, I thought for sure we would have done some more things that matter. I thought we had taken a mission trip together. I thought, you know, I would have trained my kid a little bit better on how to handle money. You know, so it's getting moments like this that can really prick your heart to go, oh, I think I want to do things a little bit differently. You know, my pace of life maybe isn't so sustainable. And the other side of it, maybe some people are, you know, kind of American dream retired and they need to pick up some more contribution. So it depends.
Very well stated. Talking today with Todd DeKreider, the author of the book, Personal Pitfalls of Money, a great conversation. I want to transition to another question that I have for you, and that is, what impact does money have on friendships and work relationships, and how have you practically guarded against that?
Yeah, one of the things, so in this writing of the book, I got to interview just a ton of people. And, you know, once we got kind of this, you know, past the syndrome where they had to, you know, I call it the Camelot syndrome, everything looks good on the outside. When we got past that, you know, have to prove that things are going well, one of the reoccurring themes I heard again and again from those who entrusted with much is that they're lonely. And that was weird for me at first. But it's amazing. It's not a felt need. You know, if I get going and building my business and building my empire and succeeding in my practice, you know, I could turn around and go, man, I haven't really put priority to my friendships. And if you think about it, our culture doesn't put a high priority on it, right? Try to think of the last blockbuster movie that was about friendship, right? We got romantic love we'll talk about. We've got family love we'll talk about. But friendship, Lord of the Rings maybe, you know? There's not a lot of movies that highlight that. And it's really easy for decades to go by without you really, you know, jumping in to some conversations with friends that are deeper. And so that was one of the shocking things I found, is it's amazing how many people are entrusted with much are lonely. And it's really common as well for wealthy people to receive a ton of judgment from those who are not themselves wealthy. There's actually a Boston College study done a while back that was really interesting. And a lot of the participants shared this loneliness idea and even shared the thought process. One gal shared that she couldn't even complain about her dad going through cancer because she'd seem ungrateful and you're not allowed to have any problems because you're rich. And so that would be a weird paradigm to be in, where you've got a friend who's not wealthy and they can't complain and even mourn over the grief that your dad's going through cancer just because somehow you've got assets in the bank. That's a weird thing to be involved with.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that. That's why I was a little stumped for my words, that just imagining that whole paradigm and people dealing with that. Now, one quote in your book that caught my attention is that success can actually get in the way of significance. Can you unpack that?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've seen is as I walk through a lot of my financial planning practice and having seen the people that started off and they really started to turn successful, was all the things that marketing tells us we need to have. And so you've got all these ways to spend money. And honestly, once you have more money, and spending money is kind of like an appetite, once you start to spend more money, you realize there's all these things that you could spend on. Like I went on a mission trip to Thailand, and I came back, and one of my clients asked me if I went on a low altitude helicopter deal shooting rocket launchers at cows. And I'm like, what? You can do that? Obviously, I didn't. But I'm just going, I didn't even know I could spend money on that. And so as you start to spend more money, there's more ways you can spend your money. And now it's not shoes or purses or, you know, Starbucks or something you're worried about, but it's, you know, cars or a second home. And you, there's all these ways that I'm like, well, every time I walk through Home Depot, I'm like, well, I didn't even know I needed this, you know? And it's amazing how quickly all of the things that are wants become needs or things that we have to have. And so there's a lot of places shouting at us, and I'm not against marketing. I think it's great if you're in the marketing industry, pursue it with passion. But it's interesting how it affects me anyway. I'll say it that way, that I'll get the whatever the magazine in it is in the mail, and I didn't know I needed it, but all of a sudden now I'm going, wow, I need it. This is interesting research I just saw yesterday on the Harvard Business Review about the risks we take with our cell phones when the upgrade comes in. And they did a study with Jenga blocks, which is just kind of interesting, but they gave somebody a coffee mug and said, hey, at the end of the study, if this is still, you know, around, you get to have it. And they set the cup on top of the Jenga tower, and they tried to get people to remove as many as they could without the tower falling over. And then they told group B, hey, this is the same thing. This is the Jenga tower. Put the cup on top. But we can also maybe upgrade you to this better mug if you wanted it. And it was crazy how many more, with the awareness of a better mug out there, took a lot more risks with the Jenga tower just because they knew the upgrade was there. And the subline that the Harvard Business Review gave it is, oops, I broke my my phone right when the upgrade comes out. And so it's interesting when you look at that and go, okay, what does that mean to my heart? What does that mean to the awareness that I have with the affluence that I have of the money I'm spending, the magazines that I get, the marketing I see, with my satisfaction and contentment of the life that I have? Right? With social media is another interesting one. We see all the highlight reel of people's lives on Instagram and Facebook and whatever else the new one is, I don't know. But we look at these things and we get to see these great vacations and cars and great meals from our friends, and yet we know the warts of our situation, and you feel like a jerk because I just yelled at my kids again, and we see the warts, because rarely does anybody ever, you know, put on Facebook of, you know, hashtag leftover night again. You know, they don't put that right stuff on there, but we put these great meals that we're having all the time. But is that the full story? Well, no, but it's really easy to get caught in this comparison trap, looking at what everybody else supposedly has and forgetting about all the things we've been blessed with.
Now, Todd, I find it very fascinating, just your background, in the sense that you seem like a gentleman that is obviously well adjusted. You've gone through this whole evolution just personally, just coming to a place in your own life of what matters. How do you enter into the discussion with your clients? Because we do have people that listen to the show that are professional fundraisers. They are estate planning attorneys. And we get the question all the time, how do we go about having conversations with our clients who may not even be charitably inclined, but they have a lot of money, but we want to use our platform as an advisor to challenge them to focus on what matters? What do you say?
Well, I think it's a really powerful position that fundraisers have. And D.L. Moody apparently said that the fundraisers will stand next to the martyrs in heaven. It's not an easy position. It's very difficult to be in those conversations. But at the same time, it's such a trusted position where you know some really intimate details. Because think of how few times we talk about money, we talk about net worth, we talk about those kind of things. And so development people and you know, entrepreneurs in the, you know, non-governmental space have really neat opportunities to walk with incredibly sensitive information with these people. And so, one, there's kind of like a sacred bond there almost that they get to have when they're talking with people about their money. So just recognize the space you're in. But then also the power you can have to encourage somebody and to speak the truth into their life on a soul level basis and have those conversations. You know, every man careth for their pocketbook, but very few careth for their soul. So what does it look like to get in there to talk to them about what matters to them and to talk to them. Okay, why are you excited about the charities that you give to? Outside of giving to our particular organization, what other gifts do you make and what makes them exciting to you? Having just kind of big conversations like that, or just asking about their kids, just talking to them about the stuff that matters, I think is huge. And genuinely wanting something more for them than you need something from them. Because I think if what you're primarily concerned about is, I want something from you, I want your assets, they feel like an ATM machine. And I talk with high net worth and ultra high net worth people all the time that feel like, man, I'm just so sick of being an ATM machine for my charities. Instead, if you can truly get in the spot where you want something for them, I want a life that is truly life. I want you to matter at what really matters. If that more is your concern than just getting the dollars, if you go after their heart to support, encourage, and just speak truth into that spot, which very few people get that privilege, that's powerful. And if you can be as much as you can, and I don't know the structure you're sitting in and how much, if you got quotas and that kind of stuff, but if you can be in a position where you can speak the truth into their soul on that, that's just a privileged spot. And you still can do the things and make the ask and all that kind of stuff. But the other piece I would give to fundraisers is just celebrating the wins with them. And so just call them up instead of asking for money. In fact, I got one friend who kind of teaches and coaches development people who says you should have however many touches, especially major donors, you should have 5 or 6 touches with them in between asking for more money. And so if you could get in the situation and just celebrate a win, just send them a quick text, or if you want to grab your cell phone, record a video real quick of, hey, just want to take 30 seconds to share with you a fun story, or a minute and a half. It doesn't have to be long. You don't have to edit it. You don't have to go through this big, long process. But just share a story of a victory that you had in your organization and send it out to them. That stuff, I know when I receive those, I'm going, man, I want my money to matter. And when I give it to a certain charity or organization, I want it to make an impact, right? And so when I get people that send me little text or pop and grab, you know, lunch or coffee with me or something and just celebrate with me the stuff that they're doing because I'm able to give to that organization, oh my word, that's exciting. Otherwise, philanthropy can kind of feel like a bill, and that's not as much fun. But if you can get the people engaged with kind of this kind of patronage together as opposed to just check writing, wow, that's a different relationship. And honestly, those conversations about celebrating the wins, those are fun. You know, talking about the next building project, that can be fun too. But if you sit down and just celebrate with the people you're working with of what your money's accomplished, man, those are fun.
That is a lot of fun. That is a lot of fun. We have about 4 minutes left, Todd. I want to make sure that you get a chance to maybe touch on some things that I did not ask in my list of questions. Can you think of anything else that I may have overlooked, or something that you wanted to say that I didn't say? Or
no, I know I've kind of been harping on some of the negatives of stuff. And I know there's plenty of positives there. I know there's plenty of wonderful things that come with it. But one of the things that I think is interesting is when dealing with kids, like we said before about that 80% number, that 80% of those who are wealthy are the first generation to be wealthy, which tells us a lot. One, that people don't remain wealthy, and those old money families are largely myth. The other thing it's unique is because the parenting issues that they're dealing with are new to them. So a lot of the poor or you know, middle class families grew up with a lot of lectures about we can't afford it. Well, now that those that are wealthy, they get these lectures, they have to move into we won't afford it. And I think a large part of that needs to figure out the family values in this legacy stuff we've been talking about. What are these values that we have as a family? What are the things that are important to us, and how do we make decisions based on our values as opposed to do we have money, yes or no? And that's a fun conversation, sitting down with your family, deciding what are the things that are important to us? What are those values? I think that's a huge tip for parenting with kids that are in a different world than you grew up in, that don't need to hear we can't afford it all the time, but you need to change your lectures. It's not the same ones you heard growing up from your parents about we can't afford it. We need to kind of change the paradigm of we're not going to afford it, and this is why. So it's a little bit different on the parenting side.
Excellent. Well, I'm afraid I'm at the end of there, Todd. This has been a good discussion. I want to give you about 30 seconds to tell our audience where they can get the book. You're doing a great thing with the book. You're donating the royalties to charity. Where can we get the book?
Yeah, it's navigatinglifebook.com. So NavigatingLifeBook.com. You can go to Amazon, search Navigating Life with More Than Enough. It's probably easier than spelling my last name because it's kind of funny. But NavigatingLifeBook.com.
Well, thank you. We've been talking today with Todd DeQuieter, who is the author of the book Navigating Life with More Than Enough, financial planner, father, husband, so many different things. Thank you so much for being with us today and learning about what matters. We'll see you next time on the Michael Chapman Giving Show. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you. It's fun to be on.
Thank you for listening to the Michael Chapman Giving Show. Join Michael at 11 a.m. Central on Thursdays as he helps you uncover the joys of giving, featuring today's best-known philanthropists, private donors, public foundations, and a host of others. To give really is to receive.
If Unity Online Radio has helped you grow spiritually through programs like this one, please consider supporting this online radio programming. Visit www.unity.fm and click on Donate Now. Thank you for helping us continue to serve as the voice of an awakening world.